Welcome to China Focus. I'm Jim Stevenson, along with Sarah Williams.
A warning is issued to those who organized an unofficial referendum on democratic reform in Hong Kong.
Thousands in Hong Kong gather for a pro-democracy rally.
A top Chinese official visits Taiwan.
Our roundtable looks at territorial tensions between China and its neighbors in the South China Sea.
And a quotation from Chairman Mao is displayed on Washington's National Mall. Hello and welcome to China Focus.
Welcome back, Sarah. Let's look at some of the biggest news stories this week.
China's state-run Global Times warned Monday those behind Hong Kong's 10-day unofficial referendum on democratic reform threatened to divide the people of the special administrative region. It said political confrontation does nobody any good, adding that it will not bring about democracy, but will only shake the region's foundation for practicing democracy.
Vote organizers say nearly 800,000 people cast ballots, mostly online, but also using a smartphone app or accessing a voting booth to be allowed to select the next chief executive, the territory's top leader, who is to be elected in 2017. However, Hong Kong's basic law stipulates all candidates must be approved by a nominating committee.
China's white paper issued last month underscored the unique one country, two systems arrangement, whereby Beijing permits a degree of autonomy, while China retains comprehensive jurisdiction over the territory, urging patriotism to the country and warning that it will not allow chaos in Hong Kong.
RAND Corporation political scientist Scott Harrell told VOA's Victor Beatty the white paper may have played a part in awakening the concerns of Hong Kong residents over the future of democracy in the territory.
Beijing has been struggling to adapt to the political realities of a Hong Kong where the population is increasingly aware of political life, aware of the differences between the normative or ordinary life of Hong Kong political life versus political life inside the Chinese mainland. And China's finding that its approaches for dealing with Hong Kong, whether in terms of outright intimidation through the white paper, or the appointment of pro-Beijing politicians, or even what is widely suspected to be a campaign of covert manipulation through replacement of critical media voices with more pliable media voices and leveraging of triads to deliver messages to those who don't get in line, are not succeeding in cowing the Hong Kong people. Instead, they've only incentivized them to stand up more to what by essentially revealing that the threat is real.
Does it matter that nearly 800,000 people cast ballots in this election?
It definitely matters. I mean, I think what it shows is that the population of Hong Kong is increasingly politically active and disposed to expect a role in their own governance. There is an expectation that 2017 will result in a real, genuine democratic election accountable to the people of Hong Kong and coming from them with candidates who are put forward by Hong Kongers, not by Beijing, and that this will be conducted according to international standards.
Do you think China will allow selection by the voters of the chief executive?
In the past, it seems to be the case that when Hong Kongers have shown a very strong, united position on an issue, Beijing has taken that on board and adjusted appropriately. Think back to the national security law discussion back in the mid-2000s. And it is certainly possible, since it's so clearly in Beijing's interest not to have the worst-case outcome here of either turning Hong Kong fully against the mainland in some sense or of having to use force.
Scott Harrell of the RAND Corporation.
This week, at least 100,000 people marched through the streets of Hong Kong to call for a fair election in 2017, when all citizens of the autonomous Chinese territory will have the right to vote for their leader or chief executive for the first time. Tuesday's march from Hong Kong's Victoria Park to the government headquarters coincided with the July 1st anniversary of the city's handover from Britain to China in 1997. The mass protest for greater democracy has been an annual event since 2003.
Many demonstrators use the march to denounce the government for its handling of democratic reform and other domestic issues. After the marchers reached the Hong Kong government headquarters, about 1,000 of them began a late-night sit-in on a nearby street. Hong Kong police warned them to leave, saying their sit-in was illegal and would seriously disrupt traffic the next morning. At about 3 a.m. Wednesday local time, officers began detaining and removing the protesters, including several pro-democracy lawmakers.
Hong Kong police say they have released the majority of about 500 protesters arrested following the massive pro-democracy rally. Most protesters did not put up a struggle. Others had to be dragged away, kicking and screaming from the protest site.
Organizers of the march said about 510,000 people turned out, while the police said 98,000 people took part in the protest at its peak. A Hong Kong University professor who leads a team that estimates the rally turnout each year gave a figure of 122,000, an increase of about 20,000 from the year before. VOA's Michael Lippin spoke with the professor, Paul Yip, and asked him why the figures from the organizers and police were so far apart.
Well, I think the police estimate, I think it's for the crowd control. I think they're just looking at the maximum turnout, right? So I think for the organizer, I think then you have to ask them. I mean, they have to come up with the number, with the data to substantiate their claim.
Now, I know that in the past, you have gone into the march and you have talked to the protesters and asked them, why are you protesting? So what did people say about why they were marching this year?
Well, I think when you see the demonstration, there are many appeals. I mean, they are for different reasons. I mean, from the lesbian gay rights, and then to the development of the North East project, and then for the animal rights, all kinds of things. And of course, I think they also express a lot of dissatisfaction about the present government.
Would you say that the demand for a genuine choice of candidates in the next chief executive election, was that one of the main demands of the protesters today?
Oh, yes, yes. I think that is loud and clear. They do like to have a genuine election. They do like to have the real choice that they can select their own chief executive.
What message do you think today's march will send to the Hong Kong government and to Beijing?
Well, I think the message is loud and clear. I think they do like to have a genuine election for the CE. They also like to have a better governance in handling the Hong Kong affairs. But I think most of the people, I think they really show their love to Hong Kong. I think we just like make Hong Kong to be a better place.
Professor Paul Yip, speaking with VOA's Michael Lippin.
This is China Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, Japan's prime minister proposes reforming the country's constitution.
The four-day visit by China's top official on Taiwan affairs, Chang Chih-jun, to Taiwan, which ended last weekend, is seen as a sign of continuing improvement in cross-strait relations, despite protests that forced him to cancel three appearances. Protesters in Kaohsiung threw white paint at Mr. Chang, waved placards calling for him to go back to China, and scuffled with police.
The high-profile visit by the Chinese official, however, is not a first. Another Chinese envoy for Taiwan, Chun Yunlin, made a similar visit in 2008, becoming the highest-ranking Chinese official to visit the island since China's civil war ended in 1949. It is part of Taiwan's Nationalist Party President Ma Ying-jeou's effort to improve relations and economic cooperation.
The two sides have boosted cross-strait economic ties to more than $124 billion last year. Taiwan expert Bruce Jacobs of Australia's Monash University told VOA's Victor Beatty, while Mr. Chang's visit underscores growing economic ties, the two governments remain far apart on political matters.
They have reached a framework agreement back in 2010, which is called the Economic Cooperation Framework Agreement. That's the ECFA agreement. Recently, there was signed an agreement called Services and Trade Agreement. The attempt of the legislature to look at that led to a number of quite peaceful protests and the occupation of the legislature for a few weeks. Then these occupants had a major 500,000 people demonstration in Taipei, but then they left quite peacefully. And most people argue that this sunflower movement was actually an important demonstration of Taiwan's democracy. And the Sunflower Movement clearly moved ahead of the opposition Democratic Progressive Party as well. And it also showed that the Ma government in Taiwan has got some serious problems in how it deals with the people and how it deals with various protests, because the services and trade agreement, there was not sufficient consultation with the various interest groups in Taiwan, and there was a feeling it was sort of being rammed through, and the Sunflower Movement stopped that. So whether that agreement goes forward or whether it goes forward in an adjusted form, an amended form, still not clear what will happen there.
How do you characterize the trajectory in cross-strait relations at this point? Where are they headed?
Well, there's a real difficulty in trying to project because the interests of the two parties are very different. China makes quite illegitimate claims that Taiwan belongs to it, and that's the answer. And there's no historical basis for that, but they say from the year dot, Taiwan has belonged to China. So in that sense, there's an internal conflict that can't be resolved because the people in Taiwan certainly don't want to become part of China. All the polls show that most people wish to retain the status quo, which is in fact de facto independence.
Bruce Jacobs of Australia's Monash University.
Japan's conservative government is making the most significant change in interpretation to its pacifist constitution since the U.S. written charter went into effect 67 years ago. That's generating some mixed reaction at home and abroad, especially in the countries that suffered from brutal Japanese colonialism in the first half of the 20th century.
VOA's Steve Herman reports Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe is defending his controversial push to reinterpret the war-renouncing Article 9 of the Constitution.
You're listening to China Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, a little bit of Chinese culture comes to Washington, D.C. Tensions between China and Vietnam have grown recently over disputed waters in the South China Sea, and violence erupted in Vietnam towards China-owned businesses. Beijing has since placed several more oil rigs in the region.
For more on the controversy, we spoke with two experts. Jacques Delisle is director of the Center for East Asian Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Carl Thayer is a Southeast Asia regional specialist who taught at the Australian Defence Force Academy and is emeritus professor at the University of New South Wales.
We began our discussion by asking Professor Delisle about whether China's new map showing its territory stretching to the coasts of Malaysia, Vietnam, and the Philippines was a new salvo in the territorial disputes in the South China Sea.
You know, the map isn't all that new in terms of the nature of the claims. It's the nine-dash line, which is what it primarily depicts, has always been there, but it is the latest salvo in the sense of they've issued yet another map, and there's some minor tweaking in the sense that it is now put on the main map rather than as a little inset the way we sometimes do Alaska and Hawaii on U.S. maps. So it's I think, underscoring a position on territory that has long been there, and it is doing so in a particularly fraught context, of course.
Yes, I'd back up the history of that. I mean, it copies from an original map of 1947-48 that actually had two other lines that were in the Gulf of Tonkin and taken out. And then several years ago, another one was added to the east of Taiwan. So this map is the latest iteration. It recalls the one that appeared in Chinese passports. And in both cases, it will just cause a series of protests.
Well, of course, recently there was a violence in Vietnam following China installed an oil rig into contested waters. And then just recently, within the last really about 10 days or so, more rigs have been put in contested waters. I mean, does this again, just this also seems to further tensions about this very heated issue, Professor Delisle?
Yeah, well, it certainly does. And yeah, this is not the first time that we've seen attempts to send exploration or oil development rigs out into the contested waters, but this is coming in a very fraught context, and it's a very big rig, and it comes in the context of China asserting that there is no dispute in its view that this is within China's waters because China claims there is no dispute about the Xisha, the Paracel Islands, and it is indeed close to the Paracel Islands. Vietnam, of course, has a different view that those islands belong to Vietnam, even though China has controlled them since the 1970s.
Well, I would just add that we first have to start with land features, and that from Vietnam's coast, they are entitled to a 200 nautical mile exclusive economic zone in continental shelf, and the rig falls in that area. The next question is, what are the paracels, and what is the nearest feature to it? Is it an island, and are the baselines drawn around the paracels legal? And when islands face coastal states, how much weight should be given to smaller islands versus a coastal state for delimitation? So I would make the point that both sides are entitled to maritime zones. They would overlap, so the area is in dispute. And under international law, they should have entered into provisional arrangements until they could delimit it, not upset the status quo, and not use force or the threat of force. And in right. my opinion, it's China that overturned these principles by placing the rig where it did unilaterally. In October last year, Li Keqiang, the premier of China, visited Vietnam, and relations went on an all-time high. And they pledged repeatedly not to undertake steps that would affect the other's position. And I was in Hanoi when the oil rig was placed, and I would just say it came completely unexpected, and I think it undermines the strategic trust that had been building up between the two sides.
Well, how does the United States respond to this situation, or how should it? Will the tensions bring Hanoi and Washington closer together, Professor Thayer?
One, I don't think the relationship between the U.S. and Vietnam is going to improve, because Vietnam has decided not to send its foreign minister to meet with Secretary Kerry, saying the matter is too sensitive. The U.S. has been pressing for more ship visits, and they haven't done it. The U.S. reaction was, to use expressions, provocative, intolerable, and at an inflection point. And I'm saying I had not seen any follow-up action to just verbal statements to that. What should the U.S. do? I think there was an arrangement over a year ago for the U.S. and Vietnamese Coast Guards to engage in training and other activities. That's a long-range solution, won't address the current problem, and nor should, I think, the U.S. get involved about deliberately trying to get the rig out of the area. China sent August 15th as that particular date.
Yeah, I think, again, one needs to look somewhat at the baselines here. I think it's absolutely fair to say that we don't see some U.S.-Vietnam alliance-like relationship emerging anytime in the foreseeable future. But all along China's periphery, China's deteriorating relations with its maritime neighbors has essentially moved them toward the United States, at the very least as a hedging strategy, and in some cases reinforcing alliances that were already on the books and in some cases fairly vibrant. As to what the U.S. has done, yes, the response so far has been largely verbal. There is a lot of skepticism in the region about whether there will be substance behind the talk of the pivot or the rebalancing. But you do see levels of discussion and talk of cooperation at least coming up. And I think the U.S. has struck a fairly sensible verbal position in saying that it doesn't have a position on the sovereignty issues here. What it wants is for free passage through the sea lanes to be assured, for the parties in the area not to engage in coercive measures or destabilizing measures that upset the status quo, and that everything should be handled according to international law, which is, of course, in favor of peaceable resolutions and not interfering with passage through the area. Now, that has not worked terribly well in terms of the reaction from Beijing, in that the Chinese position is that the U.S. is at fault for emboldening China's neighbors to be more assertive and for leaving China no choice but to push back. And that's been the argument about Vietnam, the Philippines, and in the East China Sea, Japan.
Right. Well, you mentioned alliances. I mean, of all the claimant states, only the Philippines is a direct ally.
In the South China Sea, yes, right.
Yeah. And Vietnam has a policy of 3-no, and the 3-no's include no alliances, no foreign military bases, and no using one party against a third. That's difficult to do. But again, I'm saying relations between Vietnam and China have seen an upsurge in friction. I don't see Vietnam moving towards the U.S., and indeed it's strongly reported the Politburo is very badly divided. The Vietnamese, when this is all over, still have to wake up and they're next to China. There's a strong group that wants to be conciliatory and to accommodate China. And where they're standing up over the oil rig is an exceptional behavior. We haven't seen strong statements from most leaders of Vietnam except the prime minister. So they're divided on this. I think it's important that we mention Malaysia and Indonesia.
Sure.
Malaysia is a claimant state, and very quietly it has stepped up markedly defense cooperation with the U.S., allowing U.S. carriers to visit eastern Malaysia. Earlier this year, when the ASEAN foreign ministers issued a standalone unanimous joint statement of serious concern about this private reporting is that Malaysia played a pivotal role. It's usually been quite reticent, but in getting that statement issued. Indonesia, which is not directly concerned, though, although the Chinese map would indicate its claim crosses its continental shelf area near Natuna Island, right, has taken very public steps in recent months to beef up its military facilities there, strengthening an airfield. So those are two countries, I think, that are reacting also. They're watching what China is doing, not just the oil rig with Vietnam, but pressures on the Philippines and this land reclamation activity that's occurring have raised really regional concerns. So I'm agreeing, yes, there's been a move by many to look towards the U.S. to do something about this, but by countries that are not formal allies, but are either strategic partners like Singapore or potential strategic partners, Malaysia, Indonesia.
Carl Thayer, Emeritus Professor at the University of New South Wales in Australia, and Jacques Delisle, Director of the Center for East Asian Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Tourists on the National Mall here in Washington, D.C. may taste Chinese food, enjoy Chinese opera, and appreciate Chinese arts presented at this year's Smithsonian Folklife Festival. They may also learn a quotation from Chairman Mao. VOA's Yang Chen has more.
On the National Mall, an eye-catching bamboo structure attracted a lot of attention with its bold color and the late Chinese Communist leader Chairman Mao Zedong's famous quotation from the 50s, 好好学习,天天向上, study hard and make progress every day. This quotation was in every classroom, every school in China during the Cultural Revolution era. The designer, Hong Kong artist Danny Yang, told VOA, there's nothing wrong with using a Chairman Mao quotation.
You relate to a text based on your own personal experience, and of course, I found 天天向上好好学习 extremely interesting because both proverbs start with two characters the same. 天天好好, okay. And I think this is very much to do with the Chinese linguistic structure. And the sound of 天天好好 is very, very powerful. And I love to use this kind of... I mean, this is one way for me to learn about Chinese culture myself.
But still, it raised some eyebrows that the Chairman Mao quotation would appear on the National Mall of the U.S. Capitol. Mr. Yang said the important thing is...
generating dialogues. And I think that's the essence of this Folklife Arts Festival, when you involve this particular culture with the American culture. And when we have this gateway, place it in independent mall, I think it has certain important significance as well.
He said the Smithsonian Institution has no input in the artistic design of the structure. A flower plaque used in celebrations such as business openings or weddings in Hong Kong.
As always on China Focus, we'd like to hear from you. You can email us at voaasia@voanews.com. The times are changing. Some of our frequencies have changed, and you might not be able to hear our program at the same times and frequencies that you have previously. But we are on several frequencies. You can check them all out on our program page, voanews.com/China Focus. We're also on social media, Facebook and Twitter. Sarah's handle is at VOA Williams. I'm at VOA Stevenson.
And this week we have a new feature to tell you about. Here's Zoe to tell you how to follow and contact us on Sina Weibo.
Hey guys, I'm Zoe. We are running a Weibo account for VOA English. It is a great new channel to learn English. We will provide you many English learning resources like audio, video, and a script of the latest news. The name of our Weibo is VOA 英语官博，就是官方的官，微博的博。One more time, VOA 英语官博. You're welcome.